Yeah,
House Committee on Revenue for May 11, 2009 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3465. Mazin?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. House Bill 3465 is a primary bill that tries to offer a different way of treating the bottle return and bottle deposit bill, way by which the proposal goes is to allow for the Department of Revenue to get some level of reimbursement or refund for the amounts of deposits and bottles that are not otherwise returned or paid for the cost of the distributor or the retailer. In that sense, at one time when we looked at the bottle bill concepts, this concept would be about $20 million of the unreturned amount. Primarily, it's 20% of what the total is.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning.
Senator, Representative.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you very much. Good morning, colleagues. I'm State Senator Jackie Dingfelder from Senate District 23, and I'm here this morning with my state representative.
Michael Dembrough, House District 45.
Thank you for hearing this bill today. We really appreciate you giving it the time it deserves. I'm here to talk about House Bill 3465, which brings accountability and transparency to Oregon's bottle bill. And as you are very well aware, consumers pay 5-cent deposit on beverage containers, and this bill provides an accounting of what happens to those nickels. House Bill 3465 also ensures that funds generated from Oregon's bottle bill are used for the public good. So this bill focuses on unredeemed deposits. I know you've been talking about other aspects of the bottle bill over on this side of the session. But you're probably aware that every time a consumer buys certain beverage containers at the store, such as soft drinks or now bottled water, as we expanded the bottle bill last session, they pay a 5-cent deposit on each can or bottle. But what happens to those nickels if containers aren't returned to the store? The 5 cents not collected on those containers are called unredeemed deposits, and they're retained solely by the beverage distributors. Although we lack information with regard to how many unredeemed deposits there are in Oregon, the Department of Environmental Quality has made some educated guesses based on solid waste sampling and recycling rates. And hopefully, do you have the packet that was handed out? Should have a memo in there from the Department of Environmental Quality. I hope that was in your packet as well. If not, we'll make sure and get that to you. But I had asked the Department of Environmental Quality to provide them, to provide us with their best estimates on how many beverage containers were recycled every year, how many nickels were collected, and what the unredeemed bottle deposit estimate was. And DEQ estimates that over 254 million beverage 5-cent deposit containers end up in Oregon's landfill. That's based on 2005 data because that's the most recent data that we have. And another 60 million containers were recycled in curbside pickup. So all of these unreturned cans and bottles add up to millions of dollars each year in unredeemed deposits. In fact, there are potentially, and again, these are estimates because as you will hear, we don't have the exact data, about $20 to $30 million per year in unredeemed deposits. Per year, which is obviously $40 to $60 million per biennium. So currently, this money is a windfall to the beverage distributors once you take out the money to run the bottle bill program, and there's little information available regarding to what happens to these funds. There's no requirement for distributors to account for or report on the deposits received and paid. And actually, my colleague, Representative Berger, I think it was two sessions ago, had a bill in to try to provide better accountability for the bottle bill, and that was defeated. There's limited information about what happens to the unredeemed deposits. The distributors say that the money is used to pay for their costs associated with the bottle bill. and that they will also be using the money to pay for redemption centers. But there are few methods available for verifying that. Additionally, it was never the intention of the original bottle bill that beverage distributors would generate this level of income from unredeemed deposits. And I had a law student intern work this session to put together a memo. She went back and listened to all the original, well, she read the original transcripts because they're not the audio tapes from the original bottle bill hearings. And it was very interesting to read those original transcripts because the framers of the bottle bill did not intend that money. They actually intended it at the time to go to OLCC, but nobody thought there would be as many unredeemed deposits as there are now, and of course the bottle bill has grown over time. So with that, I'm going to hand off to my colleague here. He's going to talk a little bit more about what the proposed legislation will do.
Right. Thank you again. Michael Dembro, District 45, Northeast Portland to Park Rose. And House Bill 3465 would do two major things. First of all, it would provide us the kind of transparency and accountability that the senator mentioned is needed. Under this bill, distributors will be required to account for the funds on a quarterly basis. They will make records available to the Department of Revenue for review and auditing. These will go to the Department of Revenue in disaggregated form, but for public purposes, they would only be available in aggregate form out of concern for, you know, keeping sensitive sales information confidential. So transparency and accountability is the first part of the bill. The other is that the unredeemed deposits be used for the common good. And, you know, we have a lot of precedent for that, as many states do. In this state, unredeemed revenue of various sorts goes to the State Lands Board. Gets put into the Common Schools Fund, where it's you know, potentially used for the public good. This concept of unredeemed goods going to the public good, I think, is a longstanding practice. As it currently stands in the bill, the unredeemed deposits would be put into the general fund. We haven't specified just where it would go in the general fund. As the bill develops, that's something that could be looked at. With proper accounting, the distributors certainly could retain some of the deposits for their legitimate business expenses in order to implement the bottle bill. And, you know, we haven't yet mentioned the value of the commodities themselves, the plastic, the aluminum, the glass, which is what the, you know, how the bottle bill program is supposed to be funded through the sales of those commodities. Some of the funds should be used for recycling information and outreach. This is an area where we think that the system could be doing a much better job of encouraging people to recycle. You know, just this year on January 1st, water bottles became eligible for this program, and I would ask you just how many commercials you saw, how many advertisements, how many billboards, telling people about this change in program, that water bottles are now under this program, that they should hold on to their water bottles, that whether they realize it or not, they paid a deposit on them, and they should be returning them for deposit. We have seen, you know, very little outreach in that way. I suppose, and actually I don't know, we'll be hearing more, that is probably the responsibility of, to some extent, of state government. But, you know, given our funding situation, it's obviously difficult to fund that kind of outreach. you know, these unredeemed deposits could also be used to backfill some of the legitimate expenses that state government has in implementing this program. And I just pulled off some information from the OLCC's webpage, you know, which I'll read to you. The state legislature has given the OLCC authority to administer and enforce the bottle bill. The OLCC is dedicated to the success of the bottle bill by working with distributors, retailers, and consumers to make sure they are complying with state laws. Other state agencies also play a vital role. The Department of Agriculture has the authority to enforce the cleanliness of retailer recycling areas. Department of Environmental Quality is responsible for collecting data associated with solid waste and container recovery return rates. Although these state agencies oversee the bottle bill, the government does not receive any income, taxes, or fees for services associated with this law. I think it would not be, you know, it would not be unreasonable for unredeemed deposits to help with those expenses.
What if I do this?
Yeah.
So in closing, other states that have bottle bills, you probably ask, as I did, what did they do? And there are 10 other states besides Oregon that have a bottle bill. 5 states have laws that remit unredeemed deposits to the state and require regular counting of fund transactions. That's listed on your, if you turn over that 2-pager, you'll see that listed on your handout. 2 other states, Connecticut and New York, passed laws this year to claim a portion of, or all of the unredeemed deposits generated from the state's bottle bill. So, colleagues, Oregon is now in the minority of states with bottle bills that do not claim any of the unredeemed deposits. So with that, we have lots of people here that are way more knowledgeable than we are on the mechanics of the bottle bill. If you have specific questions, I know the Department of Environmental Quality is here as well, and the Department of Justice, if you have specific questions for them.
Right. I note that both those groups are coming, and I'd ask you to hold your legal questions for the Department of Justice and the specific questions for the DEQ. Are there questions for the members? Thank you very much. We appreciate. Oh, well, there is one. Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you, Senator Representative, for being here today. I guess I'm just I'm a little bit confused. So right now, I heard that the intent was to fund the collection system in the original bill through the value of the recycled material. Is that correct?
Yes, and when the you know, when the system has been explained to me, it's been explained that that's what sustains the system is the value of the commodity.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
And how do we know now that the nickels that are coming back aren't being used in lieu of the value of that scrap to fund the existing system? How much are we talking about here?
Well, that's a great question because we don't know. I mean, our sense is that some of the unredeemed deposits are being used to offset costs of implementing the bottle bill, and that's just what we're told because, again, we have absolutely no records. The distributors do, the folks who run the bottle bill, and, again, we are not suggesting that the state take over implementing the bottle bill. That is not the point of this legislation. It's about accountability and transparency in that we do not have that information. Frankly, the distributors have fought us for years on providing that information. And so this is part of that is, you know, we are fine with legitimate costs, but with the expansion of the bottle bill, the estimates that we're getting is that this is a windfall, that there is more money than is being invested in the bottle bill. And if so, then we think that should be remitted. That's the people's money. That's the folks who have paid that 5-cent deposit. That's the people of Oregon's money. So that's what the intent of this bill is. It's not to undermine implementation of the bottle bill. It's to strengthen it. Actually, as you've heard, there hasn't been enough outreach, we believe, on the expansion of the bottle bill. The state doesn't have the resources to do that. And so we actually, the short answer is we don't know because that information is not available. So that's partially the intent of this legislation.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you. Jackie, of course, you and I have been many miles on this. If you don't know how much it costs to run the system, then how do you know how much is going to be left?
Well, it's a good question, and Mr. Chair and Representative, but the bottle bill has been run on the existing sheet or unreturned money and from the materials recovery, which we know goes up and down. We know sometimes there's better years than others. So sometimes I'm assuming that some of those nickels are used to help pay for the system maybe in the bad years when there's not good markets. But in the good years, then we don't know. But with the expansion of the bottle bill, and there hasn't been this huge expansion, you know, I go to my, Fred Meyer's, there hasn't been a huge expansion of machines and such. And looking at the, there's been a reduction in the rate of return. If you look at the memo that DEQ's provided, actually, and you know very well that I don't think anybody ever thought that there was going to be only 80% return in some years on the bottle bill. When I read the original transcripts, I mean, this wasn't, and you're going to hear from DEQ, this was an anti-littering bill. People never thought that somebody wouldn't return their bottles. And so we do have, and you'll see those numbers on that DEQ memo, that we still have, 20% of people aren't returning. So that's 20% of those nickels are going somewhere that are unaccounted for. And again, this is estimates. DEQ has a pretty good sense about how much is being returned, how much is in the landfill and such. And so that's part of this discussion, is providing that information. And having, and we're willing to have that discussion, but we need to have the information on the table.
And again, if I may, Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, I think we can look to the other states right. to see different ways of handling this. Michigan, for example, has a system where 25% of the unredeemed deposits are given to the distributors are allowed to keep them. 75% goes to recycling programs and their general fund. There are just different models out there that we can look at. Other states are facing the same issue.
One more comment.
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair. Under the Michigan system, I wonder how the folks of Michigan, whether they consider their bottle bill a recycling system or a tax system, which is what my objection to this bill is, that in Oregon we don't tax bottles and cans. We expect responsibility. And I think that consumers, if you start holding on to this money, will see it. It is a three-fifths vote, by the way. It says so in the bill. That this is another way of taxing people to their detriment. If they choose not to redeem, that's a choice. But I don't understand why there's a sense that the state could do this cheaper than anybody else, because it is, as you well know, a very elaborate system. It also rises and falls on the commodities market. There have been times, one of them is right now, you can't sell the plastic. It has no value. And somebody's holding it. Mm-hmm. I don't really want the state to be getting into the commodities market, and I don't think that's your proposal here. What you're doing is saying, you go run this system, but we're going to take our cut out of whatever system you do. So I'm just not at all favorable about this idea. It's just a backdoor tax.
Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, with all due respect, this isn't a tax. This is a deposit that is paid by the people of Oregon that is not remitted to the state. It's unclaimed. It's unclaimed dollars. The reason that this came to the Revenue Committee, because it's new funds into the general fund, so we were pretty clear about that when we talked to Legislative Council. And I just want to make it clear on the record that this bill, the intent is not for the state to take over the implementation of the bottle bill, and we're very, very clear about that on the record. It's about accountability, and it's about transparency, and it's about if those nickels are not being used to run the bottle bill, then they should go to benefit recycling or solid waste education, getting the word out, whatever. There are costs to the state of running the bottle bill. As you've heard, the OLCC and the DEQ, they do research. We get zero money in order to reimburse those funds. So I think we're pretty clear about that. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for, again, holding this hearing. And we will be happy to answer any additional questions. But we want to make sure the certified smart people get a chance to get up here as well.
Thank you. I completely agree with that. Representative Call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Apparently, I disagree. My question's brief, and it probably comes as no surprise to anybody here, given the Betsy discussion, that I'm very supportive of this idea, and that I feel like we need to be trying to find money anywhere we can to try to deal with the impending hole that's on the horizon. So my question is to follow up on Representative Bailey's question, which is, how quickly can we know what's out there? How much revenue is potentially there, What's the timeline on this?
We can, Mr. Chair and Representative Call, we can know pretty quickly because the distributors and the folks who run the bottle bill and the beverage container folks know. It has not been remitted to the state. And as we've said, you know, this bill requires that it be submitted in aggregate. So any concerns about confidentiality, proprietary information, we would be respectful. We are respectful in this bill. So it's pretty easy. It just is not required to be submitted to the state.
Representative Call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is my last question. I just want to make sure that we're being real clear here as well. Part of the discussion we had around the Betsy was that potentially changing it would undermine the system. But what we're saying here is that there is potentially general fund revenue out there that we can utilize for any number of purposes that would not undermine the bottle bill system as it exists right now at all. That's correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony in bringing this bill for us.
Thank you.
Bob Danko, Peter Spendelow. Colleagues, we have a panel from DEQ. Then we intend to ask the Department of Justice to talk about the legal issues, and then we'll get to our more general testimony on this bill. Gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Bob Danko with the Department of Environmental Quality, and with me is Peter Spindelow. Peter has prepared a PowerPoint presentation on unredeemed deposits. I will briefly make a couple of comments before he starts, if that's okay with you.
Please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the department does not have a position on this bill. We definitely understand the committee's interest in collecting the unredeemed deposits. Several other states are doing that now, and with our revenue situation the way it is, it's obviously understandable that you're looking at this. The department could support using unredeemed deposits to pay for redemption centers. The department strongly believes in what we call a dual system of redeeming containers. That dual system would be large quantities that Oregonians have to take back to redeem would go to redemption centers, and smaller quantities would continue going to the stores. And we think this dual system provides the convenience that Oregonians deserve, but also lessens the number of containers going to the stores. And we think that the dual system is good. The problem is we do not have redemption centers today in Oregon. We'd also be very supportive of a reporting requirement on the distributors, and we at DEQ would be willing to be the recipient of those reports. Right now, we've tried in the past voluntary reporting by the distributors, and that didn't work. A mandatory reporting, which would be kept confidential, as was explained before, and we would just share the numbers in the aggregate, would allow us to determine the redemption rate in the bottle bill, and that's very important. It would also then allow everyone to know how much unredeemed deposits there are. And those confidential reports wouldn't add to DEQ's fiscal work because we receive reports annually from hundreds of recyclers now, and the reporting that's going to be would be done by the distributors would almost be totally through a statewide distributor co-op that is representing those distributors. So we would only get very few additional reports if there was an annual report requirement. So just with those brief comments, if it's okay, Peter can run through his PowerPoint on unredeemed deposits.
Thank you very much. Let's go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Peter Spendelow with the Department of Environmental Quality. And Ever since Richard Chambers came up with the idea of a bottle bill and the legislature, after two sessions, passed it,
Excuse me just a moment. For the audience, I should let you know that the lamp has burned out on the main projector. If you want to see this, you'll need to look at the back wall.
Yeah.
Please go ahead.
And we have copies for those who want to come.
Thank you. That's helpful, too.
So the law was passed in 71 and effects in 72. Water bottles just added in 2009. Well, added 2007, effective January 1st of 2009. It has been a very effective bill at its intent, which was to reduce litter and to increase recycling. 10 states have followed Oregon passing bottle bills. 7 of those states now have claim all or part of the unredeemed deposit for any containers that aren't returned. 3 do not, including Oregon. Many Canadian provinces also have bottle bills. Most Canadian provinces have bottle bills, too. And I just wanted to run through how the law works, how the system works, and using my little mouse here. Usually deposits are started by the distributor. When the distributor sells beverages to a retailer, they will in turn collect a 5-cent deposit. That retailer is temporarily at 5 cents, but when they sell that container to the consumer, they get 5 cents from the consumer. So right at that point, the retailer is back even again. The distributor is holding on to the 5 cents. The consumer is out 5 cents. The consumer can then return that container to any store that's 5,000 square feet or larger, or to a smaller store that sells that type of beverage, and get the 5 cents back. That retailer in turn then can have the distributors come and pick up those containers, and we'll get the 5 cents back itself, at which point the distributor can sell those containers to get the scrap value out of the containers. So if this happens this way, if the consumer returns the container to a retailer, the money ends up back where it started. There's no unredeemed deposit. The consumer still has the 5 cents because they got it back when they returned the container. But what happens if the consumer doesn't return the container? Then it just sits there with the money, stays with the distributor, and the consumer is out 5 cents. This is the way the law was set up and the way it originally worked. But as of 2009, because of the changes that the legislature made, the distributors figured out it was going to be more efficient for them to form a cooperative that would be made up of all the distributors. In fact, not all the distributors have joined, but certainly the majority have joined. I believe that they represent over 90% of the beverage sales in Oregon. So now the system works just the way it did as far as selling down to the consumer, with one exception, and that is, and this is, by the way, my understanding. We don't get specific information on how this works because it's all privately done. But my understanding is that the member distributors of this cooperative, when they collect the 5 cent deposit from the retailers, they in turn pass that on to the co-op. And that way, when consumers return their containers, the co-op is there to pick up those containers from the retailers, and they have that 5 cents to pass back to the retailers. And the co-op can then sell that material for its scrap value. But my understanding also, and certainly the co-op could give you a lot more information about this, is that the value of the materials and the unredeemed deposits is more money than the co-op needs for that end, because actually most of the work is being done at the retail level. The retailer is having to take back the containers and do all this work. And so the co-op then can pass any excess money back to their members, which are the distributors. Or they could invest that money in making the program work better, such as setting up redemption centers or something like that. So they have a lot of options. And that's why, the unredeemed deposits might not stay with the co-op. They could be using that money, passing it back to the distributors, or investing it in the network in some way. So as Senator Dingfelder told you, we do not have any direct information on how large of amount of money this is. There was an attempt back in 1997 in House Bill 3456 to require these reports, not to actually claim the deposit, but simply to require reporting of how many deposits were taken in and how many were returned by the distributors. That provision was taken out of the bill before it passed, though, and in lieu of that, it was ask that we have voluntary reporting, that the distributors do report to us voluntarily. And we did work with the distributors. We sent out a survey, because we do regular survey of all the recyclers anyway. We asked for the specific information, and honestly, we got back very few responses, and the ones we had virtually no usable data. So it was a failure. We didn't get any good information out of the voluntary reporting. So we've been stuck with using indirect methods, such as we do a waste composition study every few years. We actually go out and grab samples out of the garbage people are throwing away. And this is a large study. We over 700 samples, each sample about 250 pounds. We can use this information to figure out how many containers are in the garbage, how many are in per ton of garbage, and we know the absolute number of tons disposed because we get that reported to us. So it's a simple thing then to take the number of containers per ton, multiply it by the tons, and figure out that, again, in 2005, we had about 254 million beverage containers ending up in our landfills. We also do a composition study. We did a composition study on recycling the same way. We went out and grabbed samples out of the curbside bins, looked to see how many containers were there, again, multiplying the containers per ton by the total tons picked up curbside. We could figure out that somewhere in the order of 60 million containers were being returned through the curbside programs without being redeemed for deposit. And then we have other information, too. We annually survey all the recyclers in the state, including the beverage distributors, so we can know. We don't know how many returns they get, but we do know how many glass, plastic, and aluminum they get. And then we have there's national sales data that we can look at and some state sales data in the case of beer. So that's the indirect information, and based on that, this is the sort of information that we found. The top line is the key one dealing with the beer and soft drink, which back in 2005 were the only beverages covered under the bottle bill. And again, about 255 million containers disposed, 63 million going through the curbside without being redeemed. Redeemed, we estimated, this is a little bit more indirect, but again, through the tonnage, we estimated that somewhere around 1,163,000,000 containers were being redeemed. So basically, at an 83% recycling rate for beer and soft drink. Water, again, was not covered at that time. But we estimate that there were about 186 million water bottles sold, which, by the way, is a lower number than the sales you find in other states. We just don't drink as much water here, but still it's a substantial amount, and it hasn't increased.
Actually, when recognize the quality of the water in some of our cities, I think we drink plenty of it. We just don't drink bottled water.
Right. That is correct. And I think that that's the reason. We really do have substantially lower per capita sales than say, California does. We're also a cooler state.
If you compared Bull Run to the water in Los Angeles, you'd understand why. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. So back then, in 2005, we estimated that somewhere around 33% of the water bottles were being recycled through the curbside programs and the depots, and two-thirds of them, roughly, were being disposed. So that's where we were back then. What's changed since then? Well, actually, we don't have another waste composition study. We're just starting to do one now, but we haven't even gotten out in the field yet on it. But we do have, again, that material recovery survey where we get the information from all the distributors. And we found that in a two-year period, 2007 is the last year we've done all the accounting for this. In that two-year period, aluminum tons being recycled dropped off 10%, glass dropped off 4%, and plastic dropped off over 14%. We then looked at the sales data, and we found that beer sales actually went up a couple percent in that period, and that would explain why maybe glass is not dropping off as much as plastic is, because a lot of beer is sold in glass. But soft drink sales went down in that period. We don't know if statewide, but on a national level, soft drink sales actually declined in that period, and a lot of soft drinks in plastic. So this would what appears is that people are returning fewer containers in 2007 than they were, that it's not just due to sales difference, that there's actually been a drop-off in the number of containers people are returning, which means that there's more. We're selling about the same overall amount of beverages, but not quite as many are being returned. And since then, of course, as of 2009, we have water in there. We don't have any sales data on water. We know that on a national basis, water sales have continued to rise sharply through 2006 up through 2007. Since then, appears on a national basis, water sales have doubled off and possibly even declined. So based on that, we did our best estimate of where we are. And if we just look at, we have separate numbers here for beer and soft drink and for water, but let's just look at the total. We now think that it's somewhere on the order of 456 million water bottles, million beer and soft drink and water bottles are being disposed. We think that somewhere on the order of 155 million are being recycled without being redeemed. That's basically 600 million containers. Some of the containers that are being redeemed, though, are probably coming from out of state. We definitely acknowledge that, but we have no idea exactly how much there is. We just did an estimate of we thought a reasonable, generous estimate of maybe up to 4% of the containers being redeemed are coming from out of state. And so if you subtract that number off, if you add together disposed, recycled, and redeemed, and then subtract out the out of state, this gives basically our estimate of what we think the sales are. And based on that, we're estimating that somewhere on the order of $86.9 million of deposits are being collected by distributors throughout the state. And the refunds being paid based on the redeemed, including the out-of-state, is somewhere around $58.8 million. And this would leave $28.1 million in unredeemed. However, I have to emphasize that these are just estimates because there's a lot of uncertainty. We don't have water sales. We don't know what they are. We don't know what the redemption rate is for water. We expect it would be lower than for every beverages because water is one thing that people take out with them in, you know, to the parks and so on a lot. And you're less likely to redeem something there than you are something like beer, where a lot of beer is consumed at the home or someplace where it's easier to hold on to it and redeem it. There's also some evidence that the recent economic upheaval that we've had nationally has caused people to be more cautious with how they handle money and end up redeeming more containers. And that's why we don't express the number in very precisely. We just put into this broad range of 20 to 30 million. Well, what are other states doing with their unredeemed? And again, we mentioned that there are seven states which claim unredeemed deposits. I put up here estimates for each of these states of what they are getting in terms of unredeemed. And Massachusetts has been the state with the Massachusetts and Michigan, the states that have gone after this the longest. Massachusetts just has beer and soft drink in their bottle bill, and they're claiming about $39.2 million. Michigan, actually, even though they have a 10-cent deposit there, they have much lower unredeemed. And I suspect that that's at least partly due to the fact that there is a 10-cent deposit, that they get back a high, very, very high percentage of their containers. Maine's kind of confusing because in Maine, most distributors are not required to pass the unredeemed on to the state. It's only smaller distributors who have not done what they call commingling agreements to allow their containers to be commingled with others who are passing their money back to the state. And so basically only about $2 million goes to the general fund in Maine, and most of the beer and big soft drink companies and the wine companies hold on to their unredeemed deposits in that state. I'm going to jump down to Connecticut and New York because those are the two last states to go after unredeemed deposit. In Connecticut, they're estimating that about $25 million in beer and soft drink and about $13 million in water will be the unredeemed deposits from both of those beverages, giving a total of $38 million. In New York, they've actually had reporting for quite a while, so they have good numbers. They're estimating about $140 million will be in unredeemed deposits, of which the state will keep 80% and 20% goes back to the distributors. So the state's expecting about $115 million out of that. And then California and Hawaii are the two states where the state actually takes the place of the co-op here and handles all the deposits and passes them out. And in those cases, they don't call it deposit, by the way, in California. They call it the California redemption value. But the state pays for the entire program, including all of their redemption centers and everything, based solely on unredeemed deposits. The value of the material is kept by the recyclers, and so that helps keep the cost down for them. But the state only has that $281 million pays all of their administration, pays for all the redemption centers, pays for the entire system, and actually gives them a fair amount of money to pass back in research grants and other sorts of promotional activities that they use. So I guess the last thing I just wanted to say is that the bottle bill has been a landmark piece of environmental legislation. It's had great aspect of, I love this picture here, the Oregon-Washington comparison. This is back from about 1974, comparing the two states on litter. It's really led to a conservation ethic in here instead of a throwaway mentality. And I work in the recycling program, and it really has been the cornerstone of our recycling program. Very high recycling rates. The recycling rate for beverage containers in non-deposit states is about 28%. Here in 2005, we were up about 83%. And the other thing, it gives you very clean recyclable material. You know, the glass coming out of this is just really nice. People don't put ceramics and stuff like that in their when they're returning bottles. You don't get all the garbage we get in the curbside. Unfortunately, we get in the curbside program. So you get very nice, clean, recycled material, and this leads to great energy savings, great greenhouse gas savings. So that's all I have. Any questions?
Thank you. Question, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we go back to the slide on the flow chart on the Oregon bottle bill?
The first one or the second one?
Either one.
Okay.
My question is about a portion that doesn't change between those slides. So this is probably a question for others also that will come up and testify, but in looking at that link between bottle slash manufacturer to distributor and then that nickel from the retailer to the distributor, how does that work? How does that section work? When a distributor negotiates a contract with a retailer, this is an area of business that I don't know much about, for shelf space, for amount that they're going to carry, is that price exclusive of the nickel, inclusive of the nickel? Is there an expectation that that nickel is just an addition on to the volume that they sell? Is there tracking of that between the retailer and the distributor? How does that work?
Okay. Actually, I think it would be much better to ask the distributors that, because the one thing that maybe some people don't know is our law actually doesn't have deposit in the law. What it has is the refund value being required. But it's based on the system that existed back in 1971 when the law passed. Back then, we still had a fair number of refillable bottles. And so back then, actually, the deposit did start with the manufacturer, because when they sold those refillable bottles to the distributor, they collected a deposit on them because they wanted to get those bottles back. That was the value of it, the getting those refillable bottles. When the legislature passed the bottle bill in 71 and then made things like aluminum cans and eventually plastic bottles also going there, the bottler didn't have any reason to get back the aluminum cans because he couldn't refill them. So they may as well stay at the distributor. And that's why the distributors are traditionally the ones who initiate the deposit. But I think it's just traditional that they know they're going to have to pay that nickel when it comes back, so they charge a deposit when it goes out. And I don't know the specifics of how they negotiate it, because, again, this is something where the state is not involved in those sorts of negotiations. So,
yes, please.
Well, Mr. Chair, with the Chair's indulgence, I have a few questions that aren't directly related to each other, but just out of curiosity. And as far as cans from outside the system, whether Idaho or Vancouver, are we able to track those returns? And do we currently track them? And if we don't, do we have the ability to track them?
Okay, the answer is, my understanding is that at least one of the distributors, I believe it's Pepsi, actually has Oregon-specific UPC codes. And so those can be tracked. But for the most part, distributors choose not to use a specific Oregon UPC code because they just don't want to keep two separate inventories. So the answer is, we don't know for sure how many are coming across the border. There's no direct way of knowing that, with the exception of those particular distributors who use an Oregon-only UPC code. But we've talked to people, we've tried to come up with some sort of a reasonable estimate, and it is true that the stores right along the border have higher return rates than ones inland, but it's not that large that would account for, 20 or 30% of our returns. It's going to be much smaller.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And to your knowledge, and perhaps there's somebody else that knows this, has the price of recycled scrap material since 1971 kept up with inflation?
Some of the materials, first of all, back in 1971, some of the materials really weren't even recycled. Glass, for instance, it was bottle bill, which actually led to glass recycling pretty much, because all of a sudden you had this good supply. They always were using their own glass. You know, when they make bottles and they break, they push them back through their system. But it was a bottle bill which developed this nice supply of glass that made it so that the Owens plant here was the first plant to really establish post-consumer glass recycling. Glass, though, hasn't kept up with prices. Aluminum certainly is higher than it was back then, but you know, the prices have gone up, but not as high as inflation has in general. And plastic wasn't recycled at all back then, so that's a new material that we weren't recycling back in 1971.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Peter, do you know what the recycling rate in California is?
It's been going up very strongly recently. I believe it's over 70% at this point. California reports every 6 months. The rate goes up and then down and then up and then down because they have seasonal sales and they just can't adjust the numbers right. But the most recent number is like 76%. But if you match that with the 6 months before, it's averaging out to about 70%.
And what was the last report period?
The last report period,
was it fairly recent?
It was fairly, yeah.
So it probably reflects economic times, is what I'm guessing.
No, it has not covered that period yet. If you take from, you know, it goes up to September of 2008.
And do they have water included?
Oh, they have water, juice. All the non-alcoholic beverages are included in theirs. They don't include wine. They do include wine coolers. They don't include liquor, and they don't include dairy.
So it's an aggregate rate, the 76?
Right, yeah. It has all the juices, and the plastic is always the lowest. And so the waters and the juices are in the California rate. It's probably one of the reasons why it's a little bit lower than ours. But it has been coming up very strongly.
One more question. Peter is, by the way, the resident expert on these kinds of things. Do you know how many water and soft drink and beer distributors there are in the state of Oregon?
No, actually, I don't, because we get reports through our material recovery survey. But we only end up having to survey a few of the distributors because in many places the distributors market through, up in here, the Portland area, they marketed through Crink in the past. And so we never had to get data from all the individual distributors. We worked out with them exactly who. But there, when water was added, that added a whole bunch of new distributors who we've, I don't know exactly who they are because there are many small water companies out there.
Which is, I think, my point, that when we added water, which we just added in January, we added an enormous complication to the system.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree? Because of the number of small distributors, which were not there in beer and wine, and pop.
There were quite a few companies that all of a sudden found that they needed to...
Which, in essence, necessitated a statewide collection mm-hmm. system that is only... 4 months into operation.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that led to the statewide was the fact that now distributors, people can return containers to any store, and so your little distributor who is only marketing in Portland might find that his container ends up being returned to a store out in Burns. And how does he go out there and get it? He doesn't sell out there, but he's required to pick it up. And that's why you really needed a statewide co-op, and that's why I really... You know, I think that they did a fantastic job of coming together like that because I've seen states like Maine where they really could use the same sort of co-op and they haven't figured it out yet. And they've got a horrible system the way they return stuff there. They could stand to learn from what our distributors have done here.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. We very much appreciate your testimony this morning and your ongoing work on this subject. Let's hear from Larry Edelman and Jazz Adams from the Department of Justice. And while you're sitting down, it's my understanding that you're here essentially to answer questions, but if you have a statement to start, that would be great, too.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, and esteemed members of the committee. My name is Jazz Adams. I'm the attorney in charge of the Natural Resource Section at the Department of Justice. Attorneys in the section advise various natural resource and environmental agencies, and one of the attorneys in the section on my right is Larry Edelman, who advises DEQ on solid waste and other issues, and he's been involved in aspects of this bill. DOJ takes no position on House Bill 3465. We're here to address any specific legal concerns members of the committee may have. You may address your questions directly to Mr. Edelman, and if we cannot fully answer any specific question, we'll be happy to get back to the committee.
Thank you. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just curious if there's any sort of legal definition around who owns the nickel after it's...
Good question.
And for the record.
Yes, I'm Larry Edelman, Senior Assistant Attorney General. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd suggest that the question of who owns the nickel is really not the correct question to ask legally. The way, as Peter explained, the way the system works in Oregon is that the bottle itself, the beverage container, has the redemption and value, and it carries that redemption value with it. So if I have here a bottle of water that's subject to a refund value of 5 cents, the nickel, and I give that empty bottle to the chair can then take it anywhere and redeem it, or the chair could give it to Representative Berger and she could take it anywhere and redeem it. So it really is the item itself that carries with it the refund value. And the way our system works, as Peter explained, is that in Oregon we don't require anyone to initiate a deposit. As a practical matter, the distributors or the distributor co-op does usually charge the nickel to the retailer or the dealer because they anticipate the refund, the container coming back and working its way back through the chain, and they anticipate having to pay out the nickel. But when the bottle is not brought back and not redeemed, the nickel simply stays with the distributor, or as I understand it in Oregon, with the co-op. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about unredeemed deposits. Does that answer the question?
What we really mean is unredeemed bottles.
Unredeemed containers.
Containers. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm even more confused now. This container has itself carries the value. Is that
correct? Exactly.
So, essentially, as it changes hands, the value of that nickel should follow it through each step in its life cycle. Is that correct?
Well, essentially correct. What I would say is that anyone who's lawfully in possession of that container has the ability to redeem it for the nickel.
Follow up, Mr.
Yes, please.
So then what happens when I drop my container in my curbside recycling? Why at that point does the nickel get separated from the container to which it's attached?
Well, because the container isn't redeemed, as I understand it. When you drop it in your curbside, it goes to a material recovery facility or there's some other transaction that occurs there, and it's not taken back to a retailer or a distributor for redemption.
Follow up, Mr.
Yes, please.
So then when that nickel is now separated from the container, who owns the nickel?
Well, again, I don't want to confuse the committee, but it isn't really a question of who owns the nickel. It's purely a question of the redemption value and the container being turned back in for redemption. And when that doesn't happen, the nickel is essentially unclaimed, but it's not a question of who owns the nickel.
It's just sitting out there.
Yes.
Other questions? I have a different question. Oregon has an interesting set of rules, constitutional rules, around the control of property that's abandoned. The analysis you've just given suggests that the container, which carries this value with it, is abandoned in the landfill. And if we were to follow the logic of that, why would this, why would the nickel not escheat and go to the common school fund?
Again, that's a good question.
The bill, of course, calls for the nickel to go to the general fund.
Yes.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, the in a sense, an unredeemed container is abandoned, but not in the true sense of the law of escheat.
Thank you. This is the thing I was interested in. Yeah.
Okay. What actually, a number of years ago, the so-called escheat to the state of the unredeemed amounts was challenged in a couple of the other states that have been mentioned as to having the ability to collect the unredeemed. And it was challenged on the basis that it was a taking of the property of the distributors. In other words, that they owned the nickel. And the courts that looked at the issue concluded, as I do, that it's not a question of escheat as such, because the nickel is charged by the distributor to the dealer initially only as a result of the bottle bill. Even though the bottle bill doesn't mandate that the distributors charge the nickel, it's only because of the bottle bill that they do. They're not simply going to add a nickel to the price of the beverage on their own. And given that, the whole refund system is a result and the creature of the enactment of the legislature in adopting the bottle bill. And because it's an enactment of the legislature that creates the system in the first place, the legislature has the ability to uncreate it. What the legislature giveth, the legislature can taketh away. And if you decide to to collect the unredeemed deposits, you have every right to do so under the law. And so, literally, the law of escheat of abandoned property doesn't really come into play. It's a creature of the legislation itself and what you decide to do in terms of unredeemed deposits. I sincerely hope I'm not confusing everybody with getting into the
You're doing great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I might just clarify that in the case of tax credits, it's much easier to giveth than taketh away.
Right. Well, that's because of peculiarities that we've added to our otherwise pristine Constitution.
otherwise pristine.
Other questions. Those are the obvious ones to me. What are the non-obvious ones that we haven't got to yet that we ought to ask you about today that we haven't asked?
That's a very good question. And I hate to anticipate legal questions that haven't been asked.
Well, we were told that you were here to answer questions, yeah. So that's one I would really like the answer to.
Well, I think the key one for you to understand, and it's the one that's hardest for everybody to comprehend, and in fact, I had to work it through a number of times and even discuss it with my wife and walk her through it so she would understand it, which is that the container carries the refund value. It's not a question of who owns the nickel. If you've got that, I think you've got the concept.
Right. Thank you. Other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
We
appreciate your testimony. Paul Romaine. I think, colleagues, we're going to get an alternate interpretation of the rules. But perhaps not. Perhaps not. Mr. Romaine, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. And no, you're not going to get an alternate interpretation. I think the Attorney General's office is absolutely correct in their legal interpretation. You can take the nickel if you want. You can take anything else. That's your prerogative. You ran for office. You can do this. Now, whether it's smart policy to do it is a totally separate question, and I'm here to address that particular issue. A couple of things. One, I want to emphasize, there is no deposit required under the Oregon bottle bill. There's just a refund value. So if a distributor chooses to not charge a deposit, they can do that. In fact, there are some soft drinks that actually come in to the state, multiple distribution, more esoteric soft drinks, where for purely their own parochial reasons, at least prior to the bottle bill expansion, chose to not charge a deposit to get shelf space, if you would. By the way, with beer and wine, you cannot buy shelf space. That's illegal under Oregon law and federal law. You can, and people do, with soft drinks, but not with beer and wine. One other misstatement, actually, that came out earlier. California does not have a deposit. There is no deposit in California. There is a refund. But when you go to a grocery to buy a product in California, you, the consumer, do not pay anything. What happens is the manufacturers and distributors are assessed some amount, and I'm not really sure what the process is, and that pays for the system. So it's simply, in effect, a tax on the system, and it's used to encourage people to bring things back. They're unredeemed, or they're not there, so they don't have an unredeemed. There's no such thing as unredeemed deposits in California. Let me go back to the origins of the bottle bill. There is one person here who was there at the creation, but she was a mere child at that time, so I will try and recreate why this came into being, and why it was a good policy, and why it still is a good policy. Let me preface this by saying that if you want to do away with the bottle bill today, every distributor in every state or in our state will help you do so. We don't like it. It costs us money. We would just as soon it go away. It's not. It's part of the Oregon fabric, and so we live with it and we make it work. If distributors were making money off the bottle bill, every distributor organization in every state would want a bottle bill. They are practical business people. It does not make logical sense in the world out there that the organizations that fight bottle bills are distributor organizations if we were making money. Now, do we somehow try and cover our costs? Maybe in a particular year, do you make some money? Possibly. But if this was a money-making proposition, we would be on board 100% all around the country. That I want to make very clear. The bottle bill started before the bottle bill came into being in Oregon. For those of you who, actually a lot of you weren't even born then, but the bottle bill, the original bottle bill, were ways for manufacturers to get back refillable glass containers. It was valuable. That was a thick glass container, and you, as the beer manufacturer or soft drink bottler, wanted to get it back to refill it. And so you put a 2-cent deposit on it, and you person paid it when they came in. It was not by law. It was the system was developed by the industry. The beauty of what the founders of the bottle bill did is they took the existing system and just expanded on it. They sort of mandated into law. And they did something that's very, very interesting. They said, we're going to just mandate that the system occur, and then we're going to back away from it. The state's not going to have any involvement. We're going to leave it to private enterprise to make it work. And that's what we do, the distributors, the soft drink distributors, the beer distributors, and now the water distributors. Fast forward 1983 when I started representing the beer and wine distributors. The biggest complaint that I would get from various folks was the back room of the grocery store. We were having problems in the back room of the grocery store. We were asked to pick up a lot of containers and they weren't there. How do we get out of that? So in consultation with a couple other folks, we came up with a cooperative idea, and took us a while to implement the thing. But basically, by 1989, we implemented container recovery, CRINC, as most of you know, up in the Portland area. It covered pretty much five counties up in the Portland area because it works well with a with a concentration. And what it did was it minimized our involvement in the back rooms of the grocers. It was a separate entity, not one who was delivering the full container, who was going to the back room. It also helped the grocer by minimizing the sorting that went on. Because when individual distributors would come into a grocery, you have to sort by distributor, because each distributor is responsible for their particular product. Saved a lot of money both at retail and at wholesale. It was a good system. Fast forward again to actually about 2.5 years ago, November of 2006. It was obvious in the 2007 that the bottle bill was going to be expanded. Absolutely obvious. So a few of us got together in November of 2006 and said, how do we make it work? And we did. We talked with Representative Berger. We talked with Senator Avakian, who came to me in the Senate and said, make this thing work. And what we did was we realized that there were two problems that you were creating. One problem you were creating and one that already existed. The one that existed was private label product. How do you take back private label product? The beauty of the bottle bill is sort of universal redemption. You could redeem product any place. But that didn't apply to private label because that was sold by only one particular grocer. So how do we handle that product? And the second part was almost everything in the old bottle up till January was delivered in exclusive territories. What that means is that within a defined geographic territory, the same distributor is going to be delivering product and picking up, responsible for it. So it made no difference where you bought or redeemed the product, generally speaking. It didn't make any difference if you went to Costco and bought a whole bunch of beer and returned it to Fred Meyer. It did to Fred Meyer because their costs went up. But from the nickel standpoint, it didn't make any difference because, generally speaking, the same person held the nickels. So where you redeemed it became irrelevant, sort of universal redemption. What we suggested and the legislature adopted in 2007 was a way to deal with those two problems. One was we were going to form a statewide cooperative because we had to get everything in. Now, we have about 90 to 95% of the distributors in that cooperative right now. There are some holdouts. There are certain areas of the state where the bottle bill is so unprofitable that the thought of giving up anything is, you know, leads you to kind of, no, I don't want to touch this thing. But eventually we think people will come around because it's the right thing to do, and frankly it makes the system work. The thing that we also changed from you having to take back, you the store, only that which you sold, to making you take back the kind of product that you sold. So if you sold beer, you took back beer. It was irrelevant if it was Miller or Bud or something else. You had to take back everybody's beer if you sold beer. What that's done, what we know has done in just the last few months, is about 40% of the private label containers are now being redeemed at stores where they were not purchased. We can only anticipate that that's a big increase in redemption because those are things that were normally just tossed. Again, we are experimenting with the program. We put together the co-op to make this thing work. That's always been our objective. Make it work. This particular piece of legislation is ridiculous state policy in Oregon. It is absurd to think that there's some kind of pile of money out there that is just waiting to be claimed by the state. A distributor or a cooperative, let's go with the distributor. A distributor is in business, prices its product, makes money by selling the full product. They also make money in Oregon if there happens to be unredeemed product, so you get to keep the nickel. Every nickel that's paid to a distributor is declared as income. Tax is paid on that product. It's expensed when it's paid out. There's no pile of money. In fact, again, back in 83, there was an attempt, frankly, by the Michigan distributors at that point, to try and change federal law to allow for those containers to be, that deposit money to be tax exempt. We thought it was ridiculous and refused to join. It's income to the distributor when it comes in, and it's expensed when it's paid out. What a business does is look at all their income, different sources, to cover all their various expenses. If you take a pile of money from here, the business has no choice but to try and raise it someplace else. It's not like there's free money out there. That's not how business works. So if you choose to go this route, just remember you're taking from here, and the distributor, be it water, beer, soft drink, has to raise prices or do something else to make up for that money that's being taken away. That money, again, I go back to the thought of the bottle bill itself. The bottle bill is a great, great thing for the state of Oregon. A little anecdote, I remember in the 80s when we had a battle over wine coolers. Wine coolers originally were not in the bottle bill. Now they're not called wine coolers, they're called coolers because the alcohol comes from beer, so they are in the bottle bill, and that's how they got in there. But the fight was over exclusive territories. And I remember, I think it was the third or fourth grade Oregon textbook had a page on the wonderful Oregon bottle bill, and I'm on, you know, this usual thing, and I'm being interviewed about the bottle bill, and my daughter, little daughter, not Danelle, another daughter, looks at me and goes, "Daddy, you're not opposed to the bottle bill, are you?" You know, it's like sacrilegious in this state. So, again, what we've always tried to do is make this thing work. You have to remember the bottle bill was designed to have minimal government involvement and to pick up litter. We have adopted and adapted this bottle bill system to make it work. It works exceptionally well. We are continually looking for ways to improve it. The only numbers that I know or have heard of come from container recovery in the early days. In the 90s, we were over 100% a number of years redemption. That's cross-border traffic. There are parts of the state that are still over 100%. If you go up to Astoria, if you go out to Ontario, I still remember a call from a distributor in the Ontario area complaining about a grocer that had a sign in the window said, "We redeem Idaho containers." I mean, you can't tell the difference. One manufacturer, Pepsi, did a separate UPC code. And from what we understand, approximately 40% of the product that was coming across in Jansen Beach was Washington product. It was not being rejected, but that was Jansen Beach. Now, it's going to be different in Bend or someplace else, but the numbers are still there. Container recovery accounted for about 53% of the state. Their numbers on redemption up until about 2003, 2004 were always in the mid to high 90s, sometimes over 100%. There has been a drop in the redemption rate, from what I understand, and I don't have any evidence to dispute any of DEQ's numbers. We do know this year, in March, anecdotally from the Beverage Recycling Co-op, we got that they were at 103% for the month of March. But again, you can't pick a particular month to determine whether or not there's over-redemption or under-redemption. The bottom line is that if there is under-redemption, yes, there is some money available to either offset the costs or possibly make a little money. But if there is over-redemption, or if it's, you know, a number that is a high redemption amount, the distributor pays for the system. The grocer pays for the system. We make the system work. The system works very well without government involvement. One little story before I finish.
And then we need to
move along. Thank you.
I'm trying to lobby to get us to 10 o'clock.
Well, we have two of the bills to hear this morning if we get to them.
Okay.
Thank you.
One little story. Just grandmother's walking with her grandson on the beach. Kids all dressed up, Sunday best, got a hat on, beautiful little hat. Big freak wave comes over, grabs the kid, sends him out to sea. Grandmother falls on her knees, looks up at the sky and go, God, how could you do this to me? You just took away my grandson. This is just horrible. How can you do this? Big wave comes, kid's on top of the wave, lands right in grandmother's feet. He's right there. She looks at him, grabs him, hugs him, looks at him, looks up and goes, the hat. So where's the hat? You have the kid. There are little things here and there. Don't break the system. Let us operate the system. Leave the distributors and the grocers alone. We're building out the premier system in the country, the one that everybody's going to be looking to. Let us do it. You can expand the system when you want to, when we get it built out. It's a forward-thinking, great system. Leave us alone. Let us do it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Romain, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Number of questions, but we'll try to keep it short. So I'm curious to ask some of the questions that we asked earlier before. That transaction between the distributor and the retailer, how does that work? Is that nickel accounted for as a line item? Is it just part of the overall cost? What happens in that interaction?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, I can speak it with beer. It's basically just a separate line item that shows deposit. There's no contract ahead of time or anything like that. We can't buy shelf space, so it's I don't know how it's done with soft drinks. I assume it's a separate line item, but same thing with bottled water.
Mr. So how much does the system cost to run?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, I have absolutely no idea. It costs different people different amounts of money. If you happen to be in a Eastern Oregon where you have to drive forever, your system of delivery and your system of pickup is going to be much more expensive. We tried to cut the costs of the system in the metropolitan area with container recovery. I know in the Eugene area with Broco, they tried to do it, and Bend with Central Oregon Recycling. They all tried to figure out different ways to cut down on the cost of the system, but I couldn't tell you.
So, and regardless of how much it costs, what's the revenue source that's used to pay for it? Is it the value of the commodity that's recycled? Is it the unredeemed nickels? How is that paid for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, yes. It's everything we have that's used to pay for everything we do. It's the cost of selling the product, the amount of money you get in. It's the amount you may get from unredeemed deposits. If you have them, there are certain distributors that don't have any. It's the amount that you would get from any kind of recycling value of product. It's everything you can get. That's how you run the business.
So I would imagine that mix is changing over time as commodity prices change and as the real value of that nickel falls, and I would assume that in general that's a downward trend. So if the nickel that you're claiming is less valuable today than it was in 1971 when you were using that nickel to run the system, is it that the costs of the system have gone down a lot, or have the prices of what you're selling risen to account for that money over here versus money over here that you described?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, again, the answer is yes. I mean, you can't rely upon commodity value because it fluctuates so much. You have no idea. I mean, it depends. If Russia is producing a lot of aluminum, then aluminum doesn't have a lot of value. If it all depends. Glass, plastic, it depends on what the commodity is worth out there. So nobody is ever banking on that. The nickel may or may not be relatively constant. For a long time, it was relatively constant at being no use whatsoever because your redemption rate, at least in the Portland metro area, was very high. So, again, it's the price of the product that usually runs the business. That's what you rely on. You have to. That's the only constant thing that you have.
Final follow-up, Mr. Chair. So if we assume, and maybe this is an accurate assumption, that moving to a system, a dual system, or with redemption centers, or even just redemption centers, would create greater efficiency in the system, that would, A, would you support that move and a mandate towards that move, and B, would we expect to then see prices of goods sold fall with that efficiency in the system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, I wrote that system. What we did with this last bottle bill, the idea of 90 redemption centers or some number of redemption centers, was an idea that, frankly, the distributor organization came up with. We decided to try and ask you to do that because we've seen what occurs in other states like Maine, where you have redemption centers that are just totally uncontrolled. As DEQ pointed out, it's probably the worst system out there. What we decided was, if you're going to expand the bottle bill, first of all, you absolutely need redemption centers. They're absolutely mandatory. Number two is, it's absolutely crazy to have other folks using those redemption centers as profit centers for themselves. You just increase the cost of the system. It would be far better if the distributors and the retailers who are in the system already, in effect, set those up. We're still playing with the return to retail. Does it work? Are there ways to make it better? We need to experiment with maybe no return at one point and then going to return if possible. We don't know. We're still experimenting with those things. We are in the process, as we have been for the last 37 years, of making this work. It's a new system now, and we will make it work the same way we have over the years. We just ask you to let us make it work.
Representative Call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few questions for you, Mr. Paul.
You can call me Mr. Romaine.
I started something. I apologize.
Just a couple questions. First of all right, let's say hypothetically then that there is a pot of money out there that is of however large you want to say it is, but hypothetically it's out there. And this bill is addressing that hypothetical pile of money that's out there. Is it your contention that if such a group, such an amount of money was out there, that the distributors are entitled to keep that money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, well, if you want to say that we don't have to pay taxes on that money, that would be fine. The problem is it's income to the distributor when it comes in, and it's expensed when it's paid out. What you're saying is we have identified a pile of money that can be sort of segregated, and that is the money that comes from deposits. And we have identified that as a potential source of money that the state can grab because it's identifiable and distinguishable from other sources of money. But to the distributor, it's no different than the sale price of the product or the commodity value of the product. It's simply income that a distributor uses to run the business.
So the 5 cents, to your way of thinking, is no different than the cost of keeping the lights on or any other thing that you incur, and when you sell your product, you recoup that. The 5 cents is part of the total profit. Whatever amount of it that you get back that doesn't go back to the consumer, any amount that you guys keep is just part of any other profit that you guys receive.
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, it's not.
I'm really trying to understand what you're saying because I'm not clearly getting it.
It's not profit; it's income. Profit is what happens after you take expenses out, and then you have profit. What the deposit money is another source of income that comes into a distributor. But it's identifiable. You can grab that. If you decide for whatever reason that you want an identifiable source of money or pile of money, and you're going to identify it as saying we're going to put the borders on it by saying it's the portion of the deposit money that exceeds the amount of deposits paid out, you have the absolute right as the legislature to do that. But to a distributor, it's simply income. It's income from one of the many sources that they have income from.
I guess my issue, and I'll move on, is that you have a dollar come through the door, and that's income to you. But when the consumer pays that dollar over, I think that they view that as 95 cents towards a product and 5 cents purchasing something better, something different. When I pay my deposit, I feel like I'm purchasing something besides the product. I'm purchasing the recycling system that exists, and hopefully that nickel is going someplace else. And so as a consumer, I am actually able to disaggregate that dollar in such a way that my nickel represents something different. And I know that when you look at it on your ledger, you're seeing a dollar coming through, and you're seeing it as the purchase of a good. But to me, as a consumer, I see something different. I'm able to separate that nickel from whatever else I'm paying for and view that differently. And I think that's one of the issues we're getting at here. Just to ask one final follow-up, Mr. Chair, is I guess what I'm wondering is, if there's no money out there, why don't we just open up the books, have a real open process, let the state of Oregon come in and take a look, and if there's nothing there, then no harm, no foul. And for me, that I'm willing to work on a compromise bill right now, put an amendment in here that says, we'll throw the books open on this thing. We'll come in, we'll do a hard audit of everything that's going on out there. And if there are a bunch of nickels sitting out there, that are going to anything else besides funding this program or dealing with the recycling efforts, well, then heck, that should come back to the general fund, in my opinion. And if they're not, right, if every single nickel that's being paid by a consumer to fund this system, because that's what the consumer thinks they're doing, the consumer feels that their nickel is going to fund this system and is able to disaggregate in a way that the corporation apparently isn't, the nickel from the total price of the good. If that is something that we can see and we can look at, and I think that we can. I think we have real smart people in this state, real smart people in our Department of Revenue, and there's a pile of money out there, then we should be able to utilize that for the purpose for which the consumer paid for it, which is to fund a recycling system, in my opinion. So, I mean, maybe we can get a compromise there, Paul.
Is there a question?
Do you think that there's a compromise there that we could reach? Is there a willingness on the part of distributors to at least open up the books so we can see what we're talking about here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kyle, the distributors were mandated to run the bottle bill. If a consumer believes that nickel, they're entitled to the nickel, and they want the nickel back, which they are, they're entitled to it if they have the container, then all they have to do under the current system is bring it back, and they will get the nickel back. We take back everybody's bottle or can. We give back nickels. If the consumer breaks the bottle, throws it away, that money goes. It stays with the distributor. It's used to fund whatever system is out there. It may be that because a distributor is making X off of that unredeemed deposit, they don't have to raise the price over here on the right side. The bottom line, if you can't look at it, it's a holistic situation. We don't take one dime of government money. We took a government mandate and we made it work. And we made it work better than anybody in the country. If you go around the country, we are the model. The reason other distributor organizations keep getting hit with a sheet legislation, unredeemed deposit legislation, things like that, is that they thumb their nose. Nobody puts together cooperatives. Nobody puts together systems. We are Oregonians. We look at it differently. We are here to make the system work. It's our system. There's no government. It doesn't work with government involvement, and we would greatly fight any government involvement in the system.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
I will pass, Mr. Chair, in the interest of time. I know too much.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I you've hit upon something really significant just in your last couple of remarks. I suspect that probably the very best way to head off this bill and others like it is to get the redemption percentage up. And manage the program in a way that the public appreciates and that the the legislature can handle. The comment you made just now about other states may be the word to the wise. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Let's hear from Steve Wright, Matt Wallace, Lori Wimmer.
Chair Barnhart, members of the Revenue Committee, I am Steve Wright, member of Tax Fairness Oregon, supporting this bill that is being discussed today. In the interest of time, I'd like to say, first of all, we agree with the issues of transparency and accountability that have already been mentioned today. We also have another reason that we would like to bring forth to you today in support of this bill. Unclaimed bottled refunds are unclaimed properties, just like unused traveler's checks, safety deposit contents that are unclaimed, and uncashed paychecks, which are managed by the Department of State Lands in their unclaimed property program. The only difference is that unclaimed bottles come in 5-cent chunks. State regulations assess fines up to $50,000 if state land rules are not followed. We believe that bottle refunds are no different, and that on page 2, line 4 of this bill, it should likewise provide that up to $50,000 fine for distributors that fail to keep accurate records and provide the reports that are required by this bill. Similar to banks and employers who must refund unclaimed assets to the Department of State Lands, distributors and their subsidiaries should be required to report and remit unclaimed values. Thank you for allowing me to support this bill today.
Thank you.
I'll go next. Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Wallace. I'm the consumer advocate for OSPIRG. We're a statewide and citizens-based public interest advocacy organization. We've been around, actually, not too much longer than the bottle bill, and played a central role in helping to pass the original bottle bill. And I thought that Senator Dingfelder made a good point when she mentioned that, you know, the original intent of the bottle bill was, of course, to have as much redemption going on as we can, and to a large degree we've been immensely successful over the last 30 years, but certainly I wish I'd sort of brought some of the original campaign materials that we still have hanging around the office. You know, what was not intended was, of course, for some $20 to $30 million to sort of go unclaimed and unused to help sort of fund that program, help fund recycling efforts throughout the state. And I think it's a different world today, of course, than it was in 1971. You know, nickel isn't what it used to be. And curbside recycling means that many people, you know, just recycle those bottles without actually receiving that deposit. Many more, of course, just throw them away. But this tweak to the bottle bill simply makes, you know, good sense. We, in many ways, just led the way, continue to lead the way when it comes to recycling efforts around the country. But now in this particular area, and what we do with the unredeemed deposits from these containers, you know, it's time for us to catch up to other states that have gotten ahead of us, which I always hate to see. So I think for those reasons, it's simply plugging a hole. It makes good sense. And certainly I think whether, you know, distributors view that 5 cents as some separate piece of money or just part of overall income, I think certainly the consumer views that 5 cents as a separate piece when they pay that deposit into the system and expect that to either come back to them or to be used for the purposes of, for a good cause. So with that, I'll just leave my spoken comments there and happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association. You might be wondering why I'm up here today. And most people don't know this, but this kind of harkens back to my beginning in politics when I was lobbying for the bottle bill in New York State while I was in college. Because of Oregon's reputation, it was someplace that I ended up landing as I started getting my feet wet in politics. So it's kind of a nice moment to be able to kind of look back on that. And you have my written testimony, but I just point out that, you know, another good reason for this bill is that you could prevent DEQ from having to do dumpster diving for data in order to get their estimates of reporting. We do believe, in all seriousness, that the monies that are held by distributors but not earned by them ought to revert back to the public. But if you can't identify the owner of the nickel or the nickel owner doesn't come forward, alternatively, giving the money to the citizens of Oregon by underwriting vital services, whether it is directly connected to the recycling endeavor or whether it is more generally for other general funded programs, makes a lot of sense. Just as you've heard today about unclaimed property under a cheat law going to the common school fund through the unclaimed property program. Deposits, which obviously you couldn't fill out your little form to get your nickel back and be able to prove that that was your nickel. So it makes sense that this alternative would be a better way to reconnect the value to consumers who were actually given this law as a way of inducing recycling, not discarding, and not as a means of income source for the distributors, although I found that fascinating that the record that the distributors understand to be the case is that they aren't making necessarily windfall profits. But who would know? Because there isn't, as you heard earlier, a record-keeping system that has succeeded on a voluntary basis. And this bill, in part, ensures that you would then have that data for a fact, and that makes some good sense in a world in which citizens demand accountability and transparency. So with that, we'd like to thank the bill sponsors for their creative thinking on this issue and on a way to keep the state running without its wheels falling off in this economy, and we hope that you do send it to the floor either in this form or some amended compromise version do pass. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions, Representative Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment that this is an example of when we hear you don't need to pass the law, we'll report anyway, doesn't necessarily work.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Let's hear from Lee Barrett, Alice Bartel, and Brooke Howell. Please, go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Lee Barrett. I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the Association of Oregon Recyclers, AOR. We were one of the first state recycling associations in the nation created in 1977. Currently, we have nearly 300 member businesses, government agencies, and other nonprofit organizations committed to the modernization of Oregon's landmark bottle bill. The focus of our efforts to enhance the bottle bill system have recently been centered on adding new containers, increasing the deposit to enhance redemption, and finding ways to make the act of redeeming containers a more pleasant and convenient experience for consumers. HB 3465 deals with an issue that has been part of the bottle bill discussion for years, but only on the periphery, the unredeemed deposits. AOR maintains a core principle that Oregon's bottle bill should be an industry-run system. And you've heard that from Paul Romaine. We believe that industry has done an excellent job in answering the state mandate to deal with the bottle bill. We believe that those distributing the product are best positioned to create and maintain a system for the redemption and recycling of the product. This concept should not change with the passage of H. Bill 3465, AOR believes that industry should invest in not just maintaining Oregon's current bottle bill system, but in enhancing the program to maximize the redemption of containers and improving the consumer experience. H.B. 3465, if amended, to give industry the right of first refusal for monies used to improve Oregon's bottle bill program, would be public policy that AOR could support. In other words, if distributors spent a portion of the unredeemed deposits on system improvements, then we believe they should be able to deduct that amount from the total due the state. It continues to be our organization's hope that government not have to get involved with the bottle bill any more than it currently is. AOR has also been concerned for many years that the current system is a reverse incentive for the beverage distribution industry. The fewer consumers that redeem containers, the greater amount of money the distributors are able to pocket. As an organization, it is intriguing to contemplate revamping the unredeemed deposit system to increase incentives for industry to invest in modernized consumer-friendly process, and HB 3465 could do just that. Let's attempt to keep Oregon's bottle bill an industry-run system that creates incentives for industry to invest in improving our redemption rates while making sure that the remaining money belongs to consumers, gets put into state programs they care about. Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Alice Bartelt. I'm the public policy co-chair for the American Association of University Women of Oregon, and I'm here in support of this bill. And I, after listening to the testimony, I think that probably the biggest challenge is to find out how much money we're talking about, and without some kind of reporting system, there's no way to know that. So I would urge that you pass this bill just so that we can find out if, in fact, there is some money out there. And if there is, we need to be able to get to it, because we have many services that are going to be cut in the coming biennium, and any amount of money that we can obtain is needed.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say the Association of Oregon Recyclers proposed amendment. I'd be happy to support that amendment that says, show us that you're using this for improving the system, and we wouldn't take that part.
Perhaps you could get together with them and craft that if you
I would be happy to.
Of a mind to do that. Others, thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3465 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2777. Colleagues, we are going to carry over the bill, House Bill 2413, until tomorrow. Thank you. Representative Nathanson is here. Chris, do you want to give us a short summary, and then we'll hear from Representative Nathanson?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, very briefly, House Bill 2077 creates an income tax credit for qualified investments in machinery and equipment. It defines qualified investments. Currently, number of the amount of the credit is blank in the bill. It's a percentage of the value of that, the equipment. It would be effective for tax years beginning on or after January 2010. There's a four-year carried forward. Total biennial limits are $30 million, and there are clawback provisions, and there's a sunset date of July 1st, 2014.
Thank you. Representative Nitzens, you've been waiting very patiently. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I can't think of a better way to spend Monday morning than hearing about litter law and accounting. It was a great discussion. I'm here to ask your support for this bill, which creates an income tax credit for qualified investments in machinery and equipment for Oregon's small businesses. The focus is the traded sector, which is essentially agriculture and manufacturing. And as you've heard in the description, this is a very targeted kind of a credit. It's designed to have a cap. It is not a blank check. There are limits on the amount, and the limits, I would hope that you would use your best judgment on what those appropriate limits should be. This bill also prevents double dipping. If you're claiming a credit on some other type, such as Betsy, you can't claim it here too. The fundamental question here, of course, is whether the cost to the state is worth the benefit. Oregon businesses are facing national and international challenges, and especially now with increasing requirements to meet the demands for the challenges of related to energy, global warming, and improving our infrastructure. I would submit that the cost to the state is relatively small for the return on the investment. In addition, $30 million for a biennium is something that can be adjusted because this program is designed to have a finite amount of money. You can define what that amount is. This is not a giveaway for big business that is already benefiting from other tax credits and low tax liability. This credit is targeted only at Oregon's small businesses with fewer than 100 employees. Many of these companies already contribute significantly to local economies and state tax revenues. Since 1997, Oregon has been among the top 17 states in the country in the terms of the percentage of its gross state product in manufacturing. About 19% of Oregon's output value comes from manufacturing such as food processing, computers and electronics, sports equipment, transportation equipment, and wood products. On the agriculture side, over 80% of our agricultural production is exported out of state, and that's what you want to hear, export. And over half of that is overseas. A thriving traded sector is vital to the long-term prosperity of Oregon's economy and its citizens. Manufacturing businesses in Oregon serve as an economic catalyst, creating high-wage jobs throughout the state and bringing new dollars into the state's economy. We can help local businesses remain competitive with large-scale and out-of-state businesses and expand even in the face of economic pressures. I'd like to provide two example stories. One is from the Oregonian in April 2007. Metal fabrication factories became more efficient, expanded or changed product lines, and increased employment. The executive director of Manufacturing 21 Coalition said, quote, companies that survived the shakeout of 2001-2002 have become very effective manufacturers. An old line industry has modernized itself to compete globally. The second example is from Helitech, a Eugene company. They say, quote, this is a type of economic development that can be very useful to small businesses, especially because the cost to invest in new machinery and equipment is often one of the greatest barriers for small businesses to overcome when the need or opportunity arises to grow or expand their operations. That's what this bill is about. It's about Oregon companies, small companies, being able to expand and compete out of state and out of the country. Oregon's small businesses did better than the national average at recovering from the devastating recessions from the earlier part of this decade. But there's a difficulty in taking care of those delayed investments in necessary upgrades, for example, aging equipment, or to implement technology innovations. The benefit of this investment is directly to our state. It's for a thriving, competitive, homegrown economy, a more stable job market, and increasing state revenues. This kind of targeted credit is what we need right now to help Oregon's small businesses contribute to the economic recovery for Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Representative Nathanson? Representative, we really appreciate your bringing this bill for our consideration. Thank
you
very much.
You're welcome.
Jody Weiser. Good morning.
Good morning. Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. So you decided early in this session to disconnect from the federal code so as not to provide additional benefit for purchasers of machinery and equipment. And this bill is a different mechanism for accomplishing a similar purpose. Whether for a small business or a multinational corporation, when you disconnected, you made that decision not to accelerate. We do have a benefit already in the tax code, which is accelerated depreciation. So a piece of equipment that might, in fact, last 20 years might be depreciated over 20, rather than over 20, over 8. And so what you would do if you pass this bill is undo the disconnect that you did earlier in the session. So the question becomes, how does buying equipment actually benefit Oregonians? Is the equipment manufactured in Oregon? That isn't required. Is the seller an Oregon distributor? That isn't required. The equipment will be installed in Oregon, but there may be no profit center in Oregon for the purchase of that equipment, except for it's going to be used in a business here. So there's no definite, clear way for us to be benefiting from it, except that the machinery is used in an Oregon business. And so it'd be good for the business owner to get the taxpayer to help pay for the cost of his equipment. Under House Bill 2777, the equipment might be sourced out of country and online. We can't be sure that this will provide any tangible benefits to the state. We can be sure of the tangible benefit of not raising college tuition costs, of not closing jails, or of not ending Project Independence. This is a year where we have to set priorities among existing programs, not start new, unproven programs. It would be lovely to be in an economic climate where we could consider doing this kind of thing for Oregon businesses, but we're just not in that climate today. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Jody? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2777. Colleagues, I think I already said we're going to hear carry over House Bill 2413 until tomorrow. And with that, the committee is adjourned.